Chapter 15. It was evening, almost 11 o'clock. Because of the events in the city, the street outside, not very busy even at normal times, had quietened down significantly earlier than usual. Light snow was falling, the flakes floating around evenly outside the windows, and the branches of the acacia trees lining the pavement, which in summer blocked the light to the Turbin's windows, were now drooping more and more under the weight of the layers of snow. It had started to snow at lunchtime, the prelude to a nasty, gloomy evening, characterized by unpleasant events and a sinking heart. For some reason, the electricity had come on at only half power, and Vanda had served up brains for dinner that evening. As a food, brains are pretty awful at the best of times, but Vanda's method of cooking them rendered them inedible. The brains had been preceded by soup, to which Vanda had added vegetable oil, and Vasilisa had got up from the table feeling depressed by the nagging thought he hadn't had anything to eat at all. That evening, there had been a mass of things to do, all of them difficult and unpleasant. The dining room table had been turned upside down, and a bundle of Lebed Yurchik's banknotes lay on the floor. "You're a fool," Vasilisa said to his wife. Vanda's expression changed.
"I've known for a long time that you're a pig," she replied, "but your behaviour recently has been beyond the pale."
Vasilisa had had an acute desire to punch her so hard in the face that she would have been sent flying across the room, crashing into the edge of the sideboard, and then to hit her again and again with such force that her wretched, bony body would have been forced to admit defeat and keep quiet. After all, when all was said and done, he, Vasilisa, had become exhausted from working like an ox, and he absolutely demanded that he be obeyed in his own home. But he gritted his teeth and desisted from hitting her. Attacking Vanda was by no means as safe an undertaking as might have been expected.
"Do as I tell you," he said through clenched teeth. "Can't you get it into your head that they could move the sideboard, and then what would happen? But hiding the money like this, it would never occur to anybody. It's what everyone in the city does."
Vanda did as she was told, and they set to work together, pinning banknotes to the underside of the table. Soon the entire underside of the table was covered in colourful banknotes, so that it resembled a richly embroidered silk carpet. His face flushed with blood, Vasilisa stood up with a grunt and surveyed the field of money spread out before him.
"But that's not very convenient," remarked Vanda. "Whenever I need any money, I'll have to turn the table upside down."
"So what if you do?" rasped Vasilisa. "Your hands won't drop off. Better to turn the table upside down than lose everything. Have you heard what's going on in the city? It's worse than the Bolsheviks. They're conducting searches everywhere, apparently, looking for officers all the time."
At 11 o'clock, Vanda brought the samovar out of the kitchen and turned off all the lights. Then she took out a paper bag from the sideboard with a piece of stale bread and a lump of green cheese. There was just one bulb alight in one of the chandelier's three holders, dimly illuminating the room with a feeble red glow. Vasilisa chewed away at his piece of French roll, so irritated by the green cheese that he almost burst into tears, as if he were suffering from a gnawing toothache. As he bit into the nauseating, powdery substance, the crumbs spattered everywhere out of his mouth and onto his jacket and tie. Unaware of what was so upsetting him, Vanda gave her husband a wary look as he chewed away.
"I'm amazed how easily they get away with it," she said, pointing at the ceiling. "I was convinced one of them would be killed, but no, here they are, all back again, and the apartment is full of officers once more."
At any other time, Vanda's words would have made no impression on Vasilisa, but just at this moment, with his whole being racked by gloom and depression, they seemed intolerably unfair.
"When I'm amazed at you," he replied, avoiding looking at her so as not to become too annoyed. "You know full well that in essence they've done the right thing. Somebody had to defend the city from those—" Vasilisa lowered his voice. "Bastards. And besides, you're wrong if you think they've got away with things so easily. I think he's—"
Vanda nodded, her eyes fixed on her husband.
"Yes, that's immediately what I thought myself. He's been wounded, of course."
"Well, why are you so pleased about it? Got away with things, indeed."
Vanda licked her lips.
I'm not pleased about it. I'm simply saying they've got away with things. But what if, God forbid, they should come here and ask you, as the chairman of the housing committee, who was upstairs and whether they supported the hetman? What would you say, I'd like to know?
Vasilisa frowned.
I would say he's a doctor, he said, averting his gaze. But anyway, what on earth do I know about it?
That's just the point. What?
Just at that moment, the bell rang in the hallway. Vasilisa's face turned pale, and Vanda turned her scrawny neck in the direction of the bell. Vasilisa got up from his chair and said with a sniff,
You know what? Why don't we run up and get the turbines?
But before Vanda had time to reply, the bell rang again.
Oh my God, Vasilisa said anxiously. It's no good. We'll have to answer it.
With a frightened expression, Vanda went with him. They opened the door leading out into the shared passageway. As Vasilisa went into the cold passageway, Vanda stood there watching him, her angular face expressing wide-eyed alarm. Above her, the electric bell in its shiny little cover rang a third time, importunately. Vasilisa considered for a moment whether he might go and knock on the turbine's glass doors. Maybe one of them might come out, and then it wouldn't all be quite so frightening. But he was afraid to do it. What if they said, What are you knocking about? Something to hide, eh? And he still nurtured the fleeting, though admittedly not very confident, hope that it wasn't them at all, but someone else.
Who is it?
He asked tremulously. At once the bell rang again, and a hoarse voice replied through the keyhole at the level of Vasilisa's stomach.
Open up! Shouted the keyhole in Ukrainian. From headquarters! Stay where you are or we'll shoot through the door!
Oh, my God! Moaned Vanda.
Vasilisa drew back the bolt and unhooked the heavy latch with lifeless hands. Mechanically, he undid the chain.
Get on with it,
ordered the keyhole unceremoniously. The door opened, revealing a glimpse of a dark street, a grey sky, the edge of an acacia tree, and snowflakes. When they came in, there were only three of them, but it seemed to Vasilisa that there were many more.
Why are you here, might I ask?
To search your apartment,
replied the first of them in a wolfish voice as he made straight for Vasilisa. The passageway revolved, and Vasilisa saw Vanda's heavily powdered face in the lit doorway.
In that case, if you'll excuse me, please, said Vasilisa in a feeble, colourless voice, might I ask if you have a warrant? I am a strictly law-abiding citizen. I have no idea why you've come here. There's nothing here. Nothing, he said,
repeating the last word in Ukrainian, suddenly overcome by a desperate urge to speak the language.
Well, we'll just have to see,
the first man replied. As the advancing men pushed Vasilisa back into his apartment, it all seemed to be happening like a dream. Everything about the first man appeared to Vasilisa to be wolf-like. His narrow face, his small, deep-set eyes, his grey skin, his straggling moustache, and his unshaven, deeply furrowed cheeks. He had a strange squint, looking out at the world with a mistrustful expression, and even here in this confined space, he gave the impression of something inhuman, of a creature used to loping through the snow and across fields. He spoke the terrifyingly incorrect mix of Russian and Ukrainian, familiar to people from the Podol region, that area of the city along the banks of the River Dnieper, where, in the summer, cranes whistle and swing back and forth alongside jetties, and scruffily dressed men unload watermelons from barges. On the wolf's head was a fur cap with a scrap of blue material decorated with gold braid dangling down on one side. The second man was a giant, almost as tall as Vasilisa's hallway ceiling. He was young, with the plump, ruddy, completely smooth cheeks of a jolly peasant woman. He wore a crumpled cap with moth-eaten ear flaps, a grey army coat, and a pair of dreadful-looking down-at-heel shoes on his improbably small feet. The third man had a sunken nose, eaten away on one side by a suppurating scab, and an ancient, disfiguring scar on one lip. He was wearing an old officer's pique cap, with a red band and the trace of a badge. An old double-breasted army jacket with tarnished buttons. Black trousers and bast shoes over thick, grey, government-issue socks. In the lamplight, his face gave off two colours, waxy yellow and violet. The expression in his eyes was one of suffering combined with malice.
"We'll just have to see, won't we?" the wolf repeated. "And we have a warrant."
As he said this, he reached into a trouser pocket and pulled out a crumpled piece of paper which he thrust at Vasilisa. With his right eye, he pierced right through Vasilisa to the core, while his left eye flicked over the trunks standing in the hallway. The crumpled piece of paper, folded into four, was embossed with a Ukrainian stamp. Headquarters, 1st Cossack Company. Underneath it was the following notice, also in Ukrainian, scrawled in indelible pencil. "You are instructed to carry out a search of the apartment owned by Vasily Lisovich, number 13, St. Alexei's Hill. All resistance punishable by execution on the spot. Chief of Staff, Protsenko. Adjutant Miklun." In the lower left-hand corner, there was an indecipherable blue stamp. The flowered wallpaper danced in front of Vasilisa's eyes. While the wolf was reclaiming the document, he said,
"Please come in, but you won't find anything here."
The wolf took a black, well-oiled Browning out of his pocket and pointed it at Vasilisa. Vanda gave a muffled scream. Then the disfigured man produced a large, threatening, gleaming pistol. Vasilisa seemed to shrink as he went weak at the knees and sank down towards the ground. At this point, the electric light appeared to flare up, making the room much brighter and somehow cheerful.
"Who's here at the moment?" rasped the wolf.
"Nobody," Vasilisa answered, his lips white. "Apart from me and the wife."
"Right, lads, take a look and be quick about it," said the wolf, turning to his colleagues. "No time to waste."
The giant immediately picked up one of the trunks and started shaking it as if it were a lightweight box, while the disfigured man darted over to the stove. The revolvers had disappeared. As the disfigured man knocked along the wall with his fists, the black air vent opened, releasing a thin stream of warm air into the room.
"Any weapons?" the wolf asked.
"Word of honor, I ask you, why would I have a weapon?"
"No, no weapons here,"
Vanda's shadow confirmed in a single breath.
"Better to say now. Ever seen anyone being shot?"
the wolf said with a meaningful expression.
"But where would I get a gun from, for heaven's sake?"
One of them turned on the green lamp in the study. Irritated beyond measure to the depths of his metallic soul, Alexander II looked down at the three men. In the green light, his head spinning ominously, Vasilisa had a premonition of what it feels like to have a fainting fit for the first time ever. All three of them immediately started examining the wallpaper. Casually, almost playfully, the giant hurled row after row of books off the shelves, and three pairs of hands began knocking along the wall. Tap, 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 the wall echoed dully. And then suddenly, there was a hollow sound as they came to the hidden safe. The wolf's eyes shone with glee.
"What did I tell you?"
he whispered soundlessly. The giant stood on the leather of the armchair, ripping it with his heavy legs, as he reached up almost to the ceiling. Something tore under his fingers, and he pulled the cover from the wall. A moment later, and the wolf was holding a paper-wrapped package in his hands. Vasilisa swayed and slumped against the wall. The wolf began to shake his head, continuing to shake it for a long time as he looked at the half-dead Vasilisa.
"So, you little rat," he said angrily. "What's all this, then? You won't find anything here, you said, you son of a bitch. You said there was nothing here, but you had money hidden in the wall. You ought to be shot."
"Oh, no, please,"
Vanda screamed. Vasilisa's reaction, however, was somewhat strange. He suddenly burst out in a fit of convulsive laughter. But the laughter was particularly horrific, as only his lips, nose, and cheeks were laughing. His blue eyes expressed nothing but terror.
"But, sir, I've done nothing against the law. It's simply some money and some other stuff, money that I've earned. Besides, tsarist money is now useless. As Vasilisa said these words, he looked at the wolf as though the sight of him gave him an unnatural pleasure.
You ought to be arrested,
the wolf said accusingly, shaking the package and putting it into the bottomless pocket of his tattered coat.
Right, lads, now for the drawers.
Vasilisa himself opened the drawers. A stream of papers, seals, stamps, postcards, pens and cigarette cases poured out. The green carpet and red tablecloth were littered with pieces of paper, the pieces rustling as they fell on the floor. The disfigured man upturned and emptied the waste paper basket. They knocked on the sitting room wall superficially, as if reluctantly. The giant ripped up the carpet and stamped on the floor, leaving intricate markings on the floor like scorch marks. The electricity, which had gone on at nightfall, blazed merrily away, and the gramophone horn gleamed brightly. Vasilisa shuffled along after the three men as he dragged himself around the apartment. He was possessed by a dulled sense of calm, and his thoughts were beginning to flow seemingly with greater coherence. And then, suddenly, chaos erupted in the bedroom as sheets, blankets, and an upturned mattress emerged, hunchbacked on two legs from the mirrored wardrobe. The giant suddenly stopped in his tracks and glanced down with a shy, beaming smile. Vasilisa's new kid boots with the patent leather toes were peeping out from under the ravaged bed. The giant grinned as he looked timidly at Vasilisa.
Lovely looking boots, he said in a high-pitched voice. Maybe they'll suit me. What do you think?
Before Vasilisa could think up what to say in reply, the giant had bent down and gently picked up the boots. Vasilisa shuddered.
They're kidskin boots, sir, he said, not thinking what he was saying.
The wolf turned to him, his squinting eyes full of bitterness and rage.
Quiet, you poisonous little rat, he said threateningly.
Quiet, he repeated, suddenly becoming even more irritated.
You should just thank us that we haven't shot you for stacking away that treasure of yours like some bandit or thief. You just keep your mouth shut,
he continued, his eyes blazing and advancing directly on Vasilisa, who had gone totally pale.
You've been hoarding all this stuff and stuffing your fat pink snout like a pig, and now you can see what good honest folk are wearing on their feet, can't you? His feet are frostbitten, in shreds, as a result of rotting away in trenches while you were sitting at home playing the gramophone, you mother...
The urge to box Vasilisa round the ears flickered momentarily in his eyes, but he restrained himself.
What do you think you're doing?
Vanda screamed. The wolf thought better of hitting someone in Vasilisa's position and simply jabbed him in the chest with his fist. Pale-faced, Vasilisa staggered backwards, feeling a sharp, anguished pain in his chest from the blow.
So this is the revolution,
the thought flashed through his pink, neat little head.
Oh, a wonderful revolution. They should all have been hanged a long time ago, but it's too late now.
Try the boots on, Vasilka,
the wolf said affectionately to the giant. The giant sat down on the spring mattress and took off his wretched pair of shoes. The boots didn't fit over the thick grey socks.
Give him a pair of socks, the wolf ordered Vanda.
She immediately bent down by the lower drawer of the yellow wardrobe and took out a pair of socks. The giant tossed his grey socks to one side, revealing his reddened toes and black scars where the frostbite had eaten away his feet, and pulled on the other pair. Yet even now the boots didn't go on easily, and the laces on the left boot snapped off. Then, smiling in delight like a child, he tied the ends together and stood up. And suddenly, as these five strange individuals followed each other step by step around the apartment, it was as if something had snapped in the tense relationship that had become established among them. Everything was now much simpler. Captivated by the sight of the giant's boots, the disfigured man suddenly grabbed hold of a pair of Vasilisa's trousers hanging on a hook by the washbasin. The wolf looked suspiciously at Vasilisa one final time to see if he was going to say anything, but both Vasilisa and Vanda kept quiet, walking around with huge round eyes, their faces totally white. The bedroom turned into something resembling a corner of a clothes shop. The disfigured man stood just in his striped, tattered underpants, examining Vasilis's trousers in the light.
"Whoa, not cheap,"
he said nasally. He sat down in a blue chair and began to pull on the trousers. The wolf exchanged his dirty army blouse for Vasilisa's grey jacket and handed over some papers to Vasilisa, saying,
"Here, take these, mister. You may need them."
Then he picked up a globe-shaped glass clock inscribed with large black Roman figures from the table. When he put his coat on, the clock could be heard ticking away underneath.
"Clocks are necessary things. To be without a clock is like having no arms,"
the wolf remarked to the disfigured man. His attitude towards Vasilisa was softening all the time.
"In the middle of the night, you need to be able to see what the time is."
Then the three of them set off back through the sitting room and into the study. Vasilisa and Vanda followed them, walking together in silence. Once in the study, the wolf thought for a moment, his eyes looking in different directions, and then said to Vasilisa,
"We'd like a receipt, mister."
His brow was furrowed. Something seemed to be worrying him.
"What did you say?"
Vasilisa whispered.
"A receipt, saying you've given us this stuff,"
the wolf elucidated, looking down at his feet. Vasilisa's expression changed, and a flush came into his cheeks.
"But what? But I..."
He wanted to shout,
"What? You want me to give you a receipt as well?"
But instead he found himself saying,
"But you're the ones who should be giving us a receipt, so to speak."
"Why, you should be shot like a dog, you bloodsucker, you. I know what you're thinking, I know. If you had the power, you'd crush us like insects, wouldn't you? I can see I can't talk any sense into you. Put him up against the wall, lads. I'll give him what for."
Agitated and angry, he pressed Vasilisa up against the wall, grabbing him by the throat. Vasilisa immediately turned a bright red colour.
"Stop!" shouted Vanda, horrified, grabbing the wolf's hand. "What are you doing? Vasya, please, I beg you, do as they ask, write them a receipt."
The wolf let go of the engineer's throat, and his coat collar snapped back into place as if on a spring. Vasilisa had no idea himself how he came to be sitting on a chair. His hands were shaking. He tore off a sheet of paper and dipped his pen in the ink. Everything in the room went quiet, so quiet that you could hear the globe-shaped glass clock ticking in the wolf's pocket.
"What shall I write?"
Vasilisa asked in a hoarse whisper. The wolf thought for the moment, his eyes blinking.
"Write, by order of Cossack Company headquarters, items such and such, to the amount, given in total."
"To the amount,"
Vasilisa croaked and immediately fell silent.
"Hand it over in course of the search. I renounce all further claims. Then sign."
At this point, Vasilisa gathered all his remaining strength and asked, averting his eyes,
"But who shall I say I've given these things to?"
The wolf gave Vasilisa another suspicious look, but restrained his anger and simply sighed.
"Right, having received all items received by Namolyaka."
He paused for a moment, looking at the disfigured man.
"By Kirpati and Hetman Uragan."
Staring with glazed eyes at the piece of paper, Vasilisa wrote down what was being dictated to him. When he had finished, he wrote Vasilis at the bottom, instead of his usual signature, and handed the document to the wolf. The wolf took the sheet of paper and examined it. Just then there was a distant crash as the glass doors at the top of the staircase banged shut, followed by the sound of footsteps and Myshlaevsky's booming voice. The expression on the wolf's face darkened immediately. His colleagues started shifting about. The wolf's face turned red, and he hissed at everyone to keep quiet. He drew his Browning out of his pocket and pointed it at Vasilisa, who gave a pathetic grin. Then they heard the bolt, latch, and chain on the door being slammed shut. This was followed by more footsteps and the sound of men laughing. Then the glass door banged shut again, followed by the sound of receding footsteps, and everything went quiet. The disfigured man went out into the hallway, put his ear to the door, and listened. On his return, he exchanged meaningful glances with the wolf, and all three of them went out into the hallway, keeping close to each other. Once in the hallway, the giant wiggled his toes in his tight boots and said,
"It's going to be cold."
He put on Vasilisa's galoshes. The wolf turned to Vasilisa and said softly, his eyes darting around,
"Right, my friend, not a word about any of this. If you tell anybody we were here, our lads will come and give you a good going over. Stay here, in the apartment, until tomorrow morning, or there'll be trouble."
"We're sorry,"
whined the man with the broken nose. The ruddy-cheeked giant said nothing, but simply looked timidly at Vasilisa, glancing happily with one eye at his gleaming galoshes. They went quickly out of Vasilisa's apartment, jostling each other as they tiptoed along the passageway to the outside door. With a rattle of bolts, the door opened to reveal the dark sky outside. Then Vasilisa closed the bolts again, his hands numb from cold. His head was spinning, and for a moment everything seemed like a dream. His heartbeat slowed and then started to race. Vanda was in the hallway, sobbing. She slumped down onto the trunk, banging her head against the wall, large tears rolling down her face.
"Oh, my God, what was all that about? My God, oh, my God, Vasya, in broad daylight, what was going on?"
Vasilisa stood in front of her, shaking like a leaf, his face distorted.
"Vasya,"
Vanda shouted,
"they weren't from headquarters or the Cossacks at all, were they? Vasya, they were just a bunch of thieves."
"Yes, I know," Vasilisa muttered, his arms flung wide in despair.
"My God,"
Vanda continued in the same vein,
"we've got to go this minute, this instant, and report what's happened, so they can be arrested, arrested. All our things, all of them. Why didn't someone?
She started shaking and slid down from the trunk onto the floor, burying her face in her hands. Her hair was disheveled, and her blouse had become unbuttoned at the back.
"Yes, but go where?" Vasilisa asked.
"Where do you think? To army headquarters and the city authorities, of course, to report what's happened as quickly as possible. What's happened to us?"
Vasilisa stood still for a moment, and then made a dash for the door. He flew up the stairs and started hammering at the glass door. Everyone, apart from Shervinsky and Yelena, crowded into Vasilisa's apartment. Lariosik, his face white, stood in the doorway. Mishlaevsky stood with his legs apart, looking at the down-at-heel shoes and rags abandoned by the mysterious visitors.
"Your things have gone for good," he said, turning to Vasilisa. "They were just a bunch of thieves. You should thank God you're still alive. To tell you the truth, I'm astonished you got off so lightly."
"My God, look what they've done to us," Vanda exclaimed.
"They threatened to kill me."
"Just be thankful they didn't carry out their threat. It's the first time I've seen anything like it."
"Yes, very neatly done," Karas agreed quietly.
"So what should I do now?" Vasilisa asked,
his voice faltering.
"Go somewhere and complain? But where, Viktor Viktorovich? Tell me what to do, for God's sake."
Mishlaevsky grunted and thought for a moment.
"I advise you not to go anywhere," he said. "In the first place, they'll never be caught. That's the first thing," he continued, holding up his long finger. "In the second place..."
"But Vasya, you remember they said they'd kill you if you told the authorities, don't you?"
"No, that's rubbish," said Mishlaevsky, frowning. "Nobody's going to kill you. But the point is they won't be caught, and nobody's going to try and catch them. And in the second place..." He held up a second finger. "You'll have to report what it was they took from you. Pre-revolutionary money, wasn't it? Well, if that's what you tell them at headquarters or wherever, they'll possibly come round and search your apartment a second time."
"Yes, that's very possible," confirmed Nikolka, as the leading search specialist among them. Vasilisa, dishevelled, drenched by the water that had been poured over him to revive him, hung his head, while Vanda quietly burst into tears and leant back against the lintel. Everyone felt sorry for them. Lariosik stood by the doorway, sighing deeply and rolling his glazed eyes.
So that's it. We all have our particular grief to bear, he whispered.
What weapons did they have? Asked Nikolka.
My God, two of them had revolvers, and the third... Vasya, did the third have anything with him?
There were just two of them with revolvers, Vasilisa repeated dully.
What kind of revolvers, did you notice? Inquired Nikolka in a businesslike tone.
How should I know? Sighed Vasilisa. I'm not an expert in such things. One was large and black, and the other was small and black, on a chain.
Yes, a chain,
Vanda confirmed with a sigh. Nikolka frowned and looked at Vasilisa, cocking his head to one side like a bird. He stood still for a moment, then he stirred uneasily and made quickly for the door. Lariosik dragged himself after him, but before he could reach the dining room, he heard the sound of breaking glass coming from Nikolka's room, followed by a howl from Nikolka himself. Lariosik dashed into the brightly lit room. A blast of cold air was coming from the open upper window pane, as well as from the huge gaping hole that Nikolka had made with his knees as he had jumped down from the windowsill in despair. His eyes had a wild look.
No, it can't be,
Lariosik shouted, waving his arms in the air.
Pure witchcraft!
Nikolka rushed out of the room, through the library, and into the kitchen, where the dumbfounded Anyuta shouted at him as he sped by.
Nikol! Hey, Nikol, where are you going without your hat? Lord, what's happened now?
But he dashed on through the porch and out into the yard. Crossing herself, Anyuta put the porch door on the latch, ran back into the kitchen, and glued herself to the window. But Nikolka had instantly disappeared from sight. He turned sharply to his left, ran down for a bit, and stopped by the snowdrift blocking the entrance to the gap between the two houses. The snowdrift was totally free of footprints or any marks.
I don't understand,
Nikolka muttered to himself in despair, and plunged unhesitatingly into the snowdrift. He felt he would suffocate. After a long time battling and scraping his way through the snow, spitting and snorting, he finally broke through the barrier. Covered in snow from head to toe, he clambered out into the narrow, desolate gap between the walls. When he looked up, he could see the brightly lit window, the fateful window belonging to his room. The black tips of the spikes, and the sharp shadows they cast onto the wall. But no tin. In the faint hope that the rope might have snapped, Nikolka fell to his knees again and again, rummaging around in the rubble. But there was still no tin. Suddenly, it was as if a bright light came on in his head.
Aha!
He cried, and crawled on farther towards the fence between the gap and the street. When he reached the fence, he felt around with his fingers, causing the planks to separate and forming a dark hole gaping out onto the street. Now he understood. Yes, that was it. They had removed several planks in the fence, got through into the gap, and had even tried to climb into Vasilisa's apartment through his larder, but they had found a grill over the window. Still covered in snow, Nikolka returned to the kitchen without saying a word.
Lord, exclaimed Anyuta, let me at least brush the snow off you.
Just leave me alone for God's sake, answered Nikolka, and went through into the rest of the apartment, rubbing his numb hands on his trousers. Larian, just hit me, will you? He said. Larian blinked and rolled his eyes.
What is it, Nikolasha? He said. Why are you in such a state?
He timidly began to run his hands up and down Nikolka's back, brushing the snow off with his sleeve. Leaving aside the fact that Alyosha will rip my head off, if, that is, as I pray to God, he recovers, continued Nikolka, the most important thing is Naitur's pistol. It would be better if I'd been killed, for heaven's sake. This is God's punishment for making fun of Vasilisa. I feel sorry for Vasilisa, but don't you see? That was the pistol they used on him, although it would have been easy enough to rob him without the help of any revolver. That's the sort of person he is. My God, what a business. Larian, get some paper. We need to seal up the window. That night, Nikolka, Mishlaevsky, and Lariosik climbed up out of the gap with nails, an axe, and a hammer, and boarded up the fence with a number of short planks. Nikolka himself drove the long, thick nails into the planks with such furious energy that their sharp points emerged on the other side. A little later, the three of them went out onto the veranda with candles and climbed up through the cold storeroom into the attic. Once up there, above their apartment, they crashed and clambered about everywhere, bending down between the warm pipes and the washing, and blocked up the dormer window. When he learnt about the goings-on in the attic, Vasilisa started showing the keenest interest in their actions, and joined them as they clambered about between the rafters, expressing his approval of everything that Myshlaevsky was doing.
"What a pity you couldn't have warned us," said Nikolka, his candle dripping wax. "You could have sent Vanda Mikhailovna to us by the back entrance."
"I don't think so, my friend," replied Myshlaevsky. "Once they were in the apartment, things were pretty desperate. Do you imagine they wouldn't have defended themselves if attacked? Of course they would. You'd have had a bullet in your belly before you'd got into the apartment, and there you'd be, a dead man, yes, dead. But letting them in the apartment in the first place, that's a different matter."
"But they threatened to shoot us through the door, Viktor Viktorovich,"
Vasilisa said in an impassioned voice.
"They would never have fired," Myshlaevsky replied, hammering away. "Not under any circumstances. Shooting would have attracted the attention of the whole street."
Later on that night, Karas was to be found luxuriating in the Lisovich's apartment, like Louis XIV. This had been preceded by the following conversation.
"But they won't come back tonight, for heaven's sake," Myshlaevsky had said.
"No, no, please, we beg you,"
Vanda and Vasilisa had said on the staircase, interrupting each other.
"Please, we implore you, either you or Fyodor Nikolaevich. It wouldn't cost you anything. Vanda Mikhailovna will bring us all tea. We'll make you up a comfortable bed. We beg you, tonight, and tomorrow as well, we must have another man with us in the apartment."
"I won't sleep at all otherwise," agreed Vanda,
wrapping herself in her Angora shawl.
"I've got some brandy. That will keep us warm,"
said Vasilisa in an unexpectedly jaunty tone.
"Go on, Karas, you go," said Myshlaevsky.
So Karas was now having a fine old time. As might be expected, the brains and vegetable oil soup had been merely the outward symptoms of the loathsome disease of miserliness with which Vasilisa had infected his wife. Yet in actual fact, delights known only to Vanda lay hidden in the depths of the apartment. On the dining room table appeared a jar of pickled mushrooms, slices of veal, cherry jam, and a genuine first-class bottle of Shustov's brandy with a bell on the label. Karas poured out a glass for Vanda Mikhailovna.
"Not a full glass," Vanda cried.
Giving in to Karas with a despairing gesture, Vasilisa also drank a glass.
"Don't forget, Vasya, it's not good for you,"
Vanda tenderly pointed out. Following Karas's authoritative pronouncement that brandy couldn't possibly harm anyone, and that it was even given with milk to anemics, Vasilisa drank a second glass. A blush appeared on his cheeks and sweat on his brow. After five glasses, Karas was in an exceptionally good mood.
"Feed her up a bit and she wouldn't be at all bad," he thought, looking at Vanda.
Then Karas praised the layout of the Lisovich's apartment and started discussing the possibility of an alarm system that connected with the Turbin's apartment. One ring would mean the kitchen, two the hallway. Anything at all, and the alarm would ring upstairs. And then there you are, it would be Myshlaevsky going to the door. Now that would be quite a different matter. And Karas continued to extol the apartment's virtues, pointing out how comfortable and well-furnished it was. Just one thing, however, it was cold. That night, Vasilisa himself brought in some logs and stoked up the stove in the sitting room. Undressing, Karas lay down on the ottoman between two luxurious sheets, feeling very comfortable and contented. Then Vasilisa appeared in his shirt and braces, sat down in the chair, and said,
"You know, I can't seem to sleep. Would you mind if we chatted for a bit?"
The stove started to burn low. The rotund figure of Vasilisa, now much calmer, sat in the chair, sighing the whole time as he talked.
"Just think, Fyodor Nikolaevich, in the course of a single evening, everything that I have earned with the sweat of my brow has disappeared into the pockets of those scoundrels, taken from me by force. But don't think I don't agree with the revolution. No, not at all. I perfectly understand the historical reasons that brought it about."
The crimson light from the fire played on Vasilisa's face and on the buckles of his braces. Karas lay there, feeling magnificently relaxed from the brandy, and began to doze off, trying to maintain an expression of polite interest on his face.
But you do agree with me, don't you, that here in Russia, this admittedly most backward of countries, the revolution has already degenerated into chaotic anarchy. Look at what's been happening. In the course of just 2 years, we have been deprived of any legal protection, of even our minimal human and civil rights. The English say...
Ah, yes, the English. They, of course...
Karas mumbled, feeling as if a cushioned wall was beginning to separate him from Vasilisa.
But in this country, a man's home is his castle is totally meaningless. If in your own apartment, with all doors and windows locked and bolted, no one can guarantee that people such as that gang of crooks who are here this evening will not come in and take all that you possess, and maybe even your life.
We'll put alarms on your shutters as well,
Karas said sleepily, and not entirely convincingly.
But surely, Fyodor Nikolaevich, my dear fellow, it's not just a question of an alarm system. No alarm system can put a stop to the corruption and decadence that is now infecting the hearts of human beings. All right, an alarm system has particular benefits, but what if it goes wrong?
Then we'll mend it,
Karas replied, feeling immensely happy.
But surely you can't build your entire life on an alarm system and those revolvers of yours? That's missing the point. I'm speaking now in general terms. I'm generalizing, so to speak, from a specific instance. The point is that the most important thing has been lost. Respect for property. And once that's happened, then everything's finished. If that's the case, then we're all dead. I'm instinctively a democrat, one of the people. My father was a simple foreman on the railway. I've earned everything you see here, everything that that bunch of thieves took away with them. It's all been my handiwork, no one else's. And believe me, I have never stood on guard defending the old regime. On the contrary, let me tell you a secret. I am a constitutional democrat, but when I see with my own eyes the way everything is going, I become more and more angry and more convinced that only one thing can save us.
Karas, wrapped in his soft, cushioned little world, was aware of the voice sinking to a whisper.
Autocracy. Yes, sir. The most rigorous dictatorship that it is possible to imagine. Autocracy.
Goodness, listen to him going on, Karas thought blissfully.
Yes. Autocracy. That's complicated.
He said, speaking through cotton wool.
Blah, 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 habeas corpus, blah, 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 the voice droned on through the layer of cotton wool. Blah, blah, they're wrong if they think, and when they maintain that such a state of affairs can carry on for many years. No, it won't survive for long, and it would be laughable to think that...
Long live Fort Ivangorod!
Vasilisa was suddenly interrupted by the voice of one of Karas's former commanders, now dead.
And long live Ardagan and Kars,
Karas responded through the mist. And through the mist came the sound of Vasilisa's polite, watery laughter.
Long may they live, sang the jubilant voices in Karas's head.